hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking all on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought and died. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program. Here on altrighttv.com or whiteresistanceradio.com. And you can reach us through either channel. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on Alt-Right TV and White Resistance Radio .com. Many things to look at and to discuss tonight, hard to know quite where to start. One of the things I'd like to talk about is Kamala Harris, and I'm just trying to find the item here that was brought to my attention. For some bizarre reason, here we are. And this comes from the American Spectator. And it has to do with Joe Biden's vice presidential nominee, Kamala Harris. Why should it matter to women that Kamala Harris slapped her way to the top? This is not very widely known. This comes from the recent American Conservative of August the 13th. It's no secret but public knowledge that Kamala Harris slept her way up into California political life by being a very public escort and mattress for California Democratic kingmaker Willie Brown. Willie Brown is 30 years older than Harris and was married at the time. It was public. It was an embarrassment. When Joe Biden is photo of metaphorically the definition of the 25th Amendment to the president, with Joe Biden's photo metaphorically the definition of the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, voters will decide in November whether they want Harris to be their president sometime in the next 4 years. Of almost equally significant concern is what Harris represents to hardworking women across the country who devote years to their careers to rise to higher positions of importance. As an attorney in my earliest years of practice, and this is the author from the American Conservative, I occasionally was assigned to work for litigation partners who are women. I cannot think of a single female litigation partner I ever met who was not brilliant, gifted, and perfectly suited to head a major litigation effort. For that matter, I cannot think of any woman among those who would be my superiors in other walks of life throughout my career who were anything less than brilliant, gifted, and perfectly suited. They attained their position by overcoming stereotypical assumptions, snickers, working for men who often doubted their mettle and capabilities, and nevertheless proving themselves to be as capable or even more capable than the male mentors who guided them on their ladders of success. I know the same to be true of my own daughters, now in their 30s. I saw firsthand how hard they worked in elementary school, high school, college, graduate school, at summer jobs, and in internships, as they broke into their respective professional fields to work their ways up the ladders in their chosen endeavors. I know the same to be true of my first wife, with whom the marriage was tough, but her professional qualifications were impeccable. And I've seen how hard she worked to achieve her goals and attain her accomplishments. And then I saw it again with Ellen, of blessed memory, my second wife, who graduated second in her high school class, fourth in her college class, and worked her way up from packing potato chips for Frito-Lay to managing white-collar investigations for decades at a major world-class university. Yet the world is dominated by stereotypes and by unspoken assumptions. Joe Biden tells a black voter that if he's not sure he's voting for Biden, then you ain't black. No one talks to white voters that way. Among the stereotypes and assumptions that unfairly hinder many women is the unspoken whisper that she probably slept her way to that position. It's a terrible stereotype, and it hurts women terribly. Do most women sleep their way up? No. Do many? No. Do some? Probably a few. And those few do horrific harm to the image and reputations of the very large percentage of women who earned everything they have achieved in their lives. That's why Kamala Harris, who openly and brazenly slept her way into California Democratic state politics by publicly hooking on to the very married Willie Brown, should matter to all women, regardless of ethnicity, color, religion, or party. Just as, despite the wrong assumptions on which she plays, Harris simply is not an African-American. Her parents are from India and British Jamaica. So, although she may be partly African, she's not really American. She likewise is not a woman who rose the way that Americans teach their daughters to achieve. Yes, she went to high school, college, and law school. Good for her. So did zillions of other Americans. And then with a law degree in hand, those other Americans had to prepare resumes, do often unpaid internship and summer volunteer jobs, if not clerkships, interview for entry level, and do the lowest on the totem pole, legal tasks at their new positions for a few years as they worked their way up. It was not as simple as just being a mattress. When I was in law school, I went the extra mile to try to make law review. I further extended myself, and through my own exceptionally hard work and months of research and effort, it successfully wrote a law review article that was deemed of sufficient quality to merit my being promoted to be chief articles editor for the law review. Over time, that same law review article would be cited by at least 9 different federal judges in judicial opinions they respectively would hand down in cases brought under the Financial Institutions Recovery and Enforcement Act of 1989. dealing with the fiduciary duties of officers and directors of financial institutions. Thanks in part to that hard work, I was offered the opportunity of a lifetime to clerk for a brilliant and gifted United States Federal Appeals Court judge, the Honorable Danny J. Boggs, who would become the Chief Justice of the United States Court of Appeals for the 6th District, and who even went on a shortlist for the United States Supreme Court. Then I began my litigation career at Jones Day, an enormously prestigious international law firm of more than 1,000 of the world's top attorneys. Alas, for all the prestige, life at the bottom of a first year as a first-year associate was often bleak, inglorious, entailed absorbing enormous personal and emotional abuse from one or two arrogant and pathological litigation partners who enjoyed lording their power and psychologically abusing their new associates and worked brutally long overnight hours. One of my closest colleagues killed herself over Christmas week vacation. She could not take it any longer. Over the next 10 years, I worked my way up the ladder, first at Jones and later at the Akin Gump Group. As I kept inching forward towards the top over nearly a decade, I knew that this line of work was not ultimately for me. Having by then married my second wife, a life partner who shared my dreams, and then goes on to some of the other things he did in his career. And I think you get you get the picture that he worked very hard. Kamala Harris's story denigrates women who worked hard all their lives. He says Kamala Harris instead is a poster child for those extremely few women who despicably chose to take the shortcut up the ladder through frisky behavior with married men 30 years their senior. Now, this apparently is widely known, but of course somehow not covered in our lamestream media, or let's say very certainly not covered in Canada. I haven't seen this reference at all to Kamala Harris. Now, it will be argued, and correctly so, that in choosing a president or vice president, as the case may be, we're not necessarily choosing a saint. Donald Trump is no saint. others before him have not been, and that's quite a fair point. But it's certainly that something I think that should be taken into consideration. Might not be the only thing, but should be taken into it. Here's a very short, interesting story. There was an elderly woman behind me, and a young 20-ish female protester offered her a pamphlet, which she politely declined. The young protester gently put her hand on the woman's shoulder and in a patronizing voice said, "Don't you care about the children of Iraq?" The old woman looked up at her and said, "Honey, my father died in France during World War II. I lost my husband in Korea and a son in Vietnam. All three died, so a naive, ignorant, self-centered bimbo like you could have a right to stand there and badmouth our country. And if you touch me again, I'll shove this umbrella up your ass and open it." I'm not sure if this is a true story or just a kind of good. one of the most evil men of the 20th century was a man named Edward Bernays. And this is a very interesting, a master of advertising and manipulating the masses. He had a great role to play both in World War II and in the post-war era, where so much of the really vile propaganda has occurred, and the manipulation of the masses. And we've got to think about that. I say particularly in Canada, but I see it going on in the States as well. The ferocious, nonstop pounding away about coronavirus has largely scared at least a substantial section of the population into a situation where they are where they are absolutely compliant, prepared to give up liberties that would have been unthinkable 6 months ago, because of the fear that has been engendered about COVID virus. Even though, and this I find very interesting, even though most will have to acknowledge that they don't know anybody who died of COVID virus. In many cases, they don't even know anybody who had COVID virus. And you would think, and I find it disappointing that this is not the case with many people, you would think that their personal experiences would argue against the hysteria. Just what they'd seen would have contradicted things. Well, I'm having some trouble getting this thing to appear, so I'm going to while I await that, see if I can get something else up here for you. This is Tucker Carlson, and with the question, has life improved in democratic cities? Not quite sure why I'm having so much trouble getting this up for you. I'm going to try this in a slightly different way. We do have our internet problems, don't we? I want to thank Rosemary for sending this my way. A good supporter in the Toronto area. And this is about Edward Bernays manipulating the masses.
The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. In almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons.
The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. In almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind, who harness old social forces and contrive new ways to bind and guide the world. This passage was written by Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and a pioneering mind behind advertising, modern propaganda, and the field of public relations. Bernays' influence was enormous. Relying heavily on the insights of his uncle, he developed highly successful manipulation techniques which are still used today, not only by companies to sell consumer products, but also by the powers that be to, in the words of Bernays, control and regiment the masses. In this video, we'll explore some of Bernays' most intriguing ideas, paying particular attention to his insights on how group psychology can be used to control and manipulate the masses. In his classic work, Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego, Sigmund Freud described group psychology as being concerned with the individual man as a member of a race, of a nation, of a caste, of a profession, of an institution, or as a component part of a crowd of people who have been organized into a group at some particular time for some definite purpose. In other words, group psychology attempts to understand how an individual's behavior, thoughts, and emotions change when becoming a part of a group. The tendency of human beings to form groups was selected for in our evolutionary past due to the survival benefits it offered. Ancient humans who organized into tribes were more likely to survive and reproduce in the harsh environments in which they lived. However, with the help of modern technologies, humans today have transformed the environment in a manner which renders the survival value of tribal organization obsolete. But with that said, the ancient and instinctual pull of tribal organization still looms large in the lives of most, with many people today identifying and hence stereotyping both themselves and others based on things such as race, class, gender, nationality, religion, or the political party or ideology to which one adheres. This continued proclivity to engage in group identification is, according to Bernays, a function of the enlarged sense of self-importance that individuals derive from identifying with a potentially powerful mass. Just as the wolf pack is many times as strong as the combined strength of its individual members, so too the individual senses the potential power of the group, and it derives feelings of potency in identifying with it. Beginning in the late 19th century, a number of thinkers, most notably Freud and Gustave Le Bon, attempted to understand why people engage in group identification and how group identification affects one's mind and behavior. As Bernays noted, the insights that emerged from this study caught the attention of those in positions of power who wanted to expand their control of societies. These people saw the potential of taking the theoretical insights of group psychology and transforming them into practical methods that could be used to manipulate the masses from outside of the public's eye, a task which formed the basis of Bernays' work in public relations. As Bernays explained in his book, Propaganda, the systematic study of mass psychology revealed the potentialities of invisible government of society by manipulation of the motives which actuate man in the group. These studies established that the group has mental characteristics distinct from those of the individual, and is motivated by impulses and emotions which cannot be explained on the basis of what we know of individual psychology. So the question naturally arose, if we understand the mechanism and motives of the group mind, is it not possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without their knowing it? The great potential of using insights from group psychology to control the masses is partly a function of the fact that an individual can be influenced by a group or crowd even when physically isolated. As Bernays pointed out in his book, Crystallizing Public Opinion, a crowd does not mean merely a physical aggregation of a number of persons. The crowd is rather a state of mind. So long as one engages in group identification, their mind and behavior will be changed by the enduring influence of group psychology, even with no other members of the group physically present. To understand how the tendency of human beings to engage in group identification renders the masses manipulable, we must turn to one of Freud's ideas which heavily influenced the manipulation techniques developed by Bernays. In his book Propaganda, published in 1928, Bernays explained, "It is chiefly the psychologists of the school of Freud who have pointed out that many of man's thoughts and actions are compensatory substitutes for desires which he has been obliged to suppress. A thing may be desired not for its intrinsic worth or usefulness, but because he has unconsciously come to see in it a symbol of something else, the desire for which he is ashamed to admit to himself. A man buying a car may think he wants it for purposes of locomotion. He may really want it because it is a symbol of social position, an evidence of his success in business, or a means of pleasing his wife." What Freud suggested is that often there is a divorce between one's conscious thoughts and feelings and desires which do not fit with one's self-image and which are therefore suppressed. This fact, Bernays recognized, renders human beings manipulable. For what it implies is that if one can design propaganda or psychological operations that bypass the conscious and rational faculties of the individual, targeting instead suppressed emotions and hidden desires, It is possible to move people to adopt beliefs and behaviors without them being aware of the underlying motivations leading them on. As Bernays explained, men are very largely actuated by motives which they conceal from themselves. It is evident that the successful propagandist must understand the true motives, and not be content to accept the reasons which men give for what they do. It is possible, although often difficult, for an individual to become aware of the underlying motives driving their beliefs and actions through honest and critical introspection. However, once one succumbs to the effects of group identification, such critical introspection becomes nearly impossible. A group is extraordinarily credulous and open to influence, wrote Freud. It has no critical faculty. In identifying with a group, the individual subordinates self-analysis and a discerning search for the truth in favor of maintaining group interests and cohesion. And with their critical capacities weakened by the influence of group psychology, they become highly susceptible to psychological operations designed to target suppressed or unconscious desires and emotions. In the modern day, there appears to be forces operating through the mainstream media and popular culture which are attempting to increase the individual's proclivity to engage in certain types of group identification, namely, identifications that divide the population into conflicting groups. This phenomenon has potentially dire consequences for both the stability and freedom of a society, as it allows those in power to institute the age-old tactic of divide and conquer. In his book, Discourses on Livy, Machiavelli noted that those who have held power over a population have long realized that a population united is always stronger than those who rule over it, and thus stretching back into ancient times, rulers have sought to divide the many and weaken the force which was strong while it was united through the use of those methods which promote division. By dividing a population along lines such as race, class, religion, gender, or political preference, or in other words, into groups naturally prone to clash, the effects of group psychology render rational discourse and debate between individuals in these separate groups extremely unlikely. Each group, Bernays wrote, considers its own standards ultimate and indisputable, and tends to dismiss all contrary or different standards as indefensible. Unable to settle differences in opinions via rational discourse, groups whose belief structures clash tend to revert to more destructive means in their attempt to defeat those they perceive as a threat. A society dominated by such groups is thus easily divided in increasingly hostile conflict, and as a result, not only does the population as a whole become weakened, as Machiavelli pointed out, but its eyes are diverted away from the actions of those operating behind the scenes, who constitute, in the words of Bernays, the invisible government who controls the destinies of millions. While there is nothing wrong with deriving a sense of belonging based on the commonalities we share with others, it is misguided to base our personal identity primarily on our group memberships. In terms of our evolutionary history, it is only fairly recently that we developed the ability to become aware of ourselves as individuals, separate from any group or tribe. This was a crucial development in consciousness, as the existence of a society based on individual rights and personal liberties is dependent on a population which has developed this capacity for individual consciousness, or in other words, on a society of individuals who understand themselves and treat others as individuals first and foremost. As Eric Neumann pointed out in his classic work, The Origins and History of Consciousness, prior to the development of this capacity for individual consciousness, the group and group consciousness were dominant. The individual was not an autonomous, individualized entity with a knowledge, morality, volition, and activity of its own. It functioned solely as a part of the group, and the group, with its superordinate power, was the only real subject. Seen in this light, the proclivity of individuals today to engage in group identification is not only a danger to the freedom and stability of a society, but it is also a regression of consciousness
like wearing masks
to a more primitive psychological state, and therefore, from the standpoint of modernity, a pathological tendency that needs to be overcome, or as Sigmund Freud put it. Each individual has a share in numerous group minds, those of his race, of his class, of his creed, of his nationality, etc. and he can also raise himself above them to the extent of having a scrap of independence and originality.
I thought that was a very, very interesting little video. And here's a take from Australia. I've reported a couple of times on the just horrific things that have happened, especially in the state of Victoria with the lockdown, virtual martial law. The right of the police to burst in and without a warrant to search premises to see that the various rules are being followed, ferocious fines, an absolute horror situation. We're going to try to get this for you, which I am having my problems tonight, aren't I? About the lockdown in Australia, and it's an interview with Serena Tafaha who and Molly from the Health Australia Party, and here we are.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Health Australia Party. I'm Molly. Oh, you're still there.
I'm going to play a little bit of this. It's quite long. At least I think I'm going to play this. And it certainly shows what we're seeing in Canada of health or health acts being used the means to enslave us. It all sounds pretty.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Health Australia Party. I'm Molly. Talking about the state of emergency in Victoria. Do you think has the government acted in accordance with the law when declaring this state of emergency? And I wanted to know what conditions or situations, like the points that a government body would have, they have to tick these off, that would lead to having such a dramatic and desperate situation, the response that, well, basically closes everything down. So what gives a government the right to call a state of emergency?
Well, I think it's really important to understand what public health risk is and link it to state of emergency powers. So state of emergency powers are when they can be declared as well, and by who. And who has the original, autonomy or decision-making in terms of national public health risks that would affect the whole country. It's important to understand the legislative framework under which this works as well. What's important to understand here is that Australia has a number of legislative frameworks. There is the Commonwealth or the federal framework of managing states of emergencies and public health risks, and that sits within the Biosecurity Act on the national level, and that's an act that came in 2015. That piece of legislation, I would say, is a good piece of legislation. It's been very well thought out in terms of how to roll out and when to declare a state of emergency, and I will come back to that in a short bit. The other layer that operates is the states and the territories' powers as well. And the federal legislator is not carving out the states and the territories from having a say in relation to public health issues. And those are usually captured in the respective public health acts an emergency act that operates on the under the jurisdiction of the relevant states and territories. Now, those acts, unfortunately, have come much earlier. Okay, so each of the states and territories have had acts, some of them in 1970s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s. And unfortunately, those acts, when you read them holistically, because they've had so many different amendments happen to them throughout the years, they can read in almost in conflict with themselves. Okay, but what the Biosecurity Act did when it came in on the federal level, it actually created a precedent in itself. It means that all the states and territories, when it comes to public health risk and management, they have to work, they can't be inconsistent with the authority of the Biosecurity Act. The Biosecurity Act that is the following, that agency, the health minister that sits on the federal level and the governor general must declare the emergency and do a declaration order. Now that was made under section 475 of the Biosecurity Act. And the declaration order for the state of emergency creates a priority in the federal minister, okay, on the higher level, and the rules must be applied 100% with no conflict to the Biosecurity Act. Okay, now I will explain when a state of emergency can occur. So what the Biosecurity Act says under sections 475 is that the Governor General may declare that a human biosecurity emergency exists if the health minister is satisfied that a listed human disease is posing a severe and immediate threat or is causing harm to human health on a nationally significant scale. They're actually very powerful words and very serious, on a national significant scale. And the declaration is necessary to prevent or control the obviously the emergence of the listed human disease into the Australian territory and the emergence and the establishment of the spread of that disease. So you can see that the criteria is extremely high. Mm. And so the questions have to be is, well, when is a disease such that it poses, when can you classify it as posing a serious threat of harm, okay, and that is on a national significant scale? What the Biosecurity Act also says, you can't bring a risk to zero. So don't try to do that. That is not a realistic thing to do, okay? What is realistic is managing it so it's no longer a significant health risk. So on the 18th of March, it was determined, obviously, in response to the global issue for a novel coronavirus, that the uncertainties related to it would have probably necessitated, let's say, a declaration of an emergency. But we need to now assess 4 or 5 months on what has happened and what we have learned. And therefore that assessment has to come through with our learning. And we need to ask, well, is it still a nationally significant risk? What do we know about this virus? Do we know how many people are asymptomatic? What are the percentages? What are the likely comorbidity? What is the likely risk of people dying with comorbidity of other diseases? What are the age groups? And what is the causal fatality rate? Now, what is the causal fatality rate? The causal fatality rate is actually an ascertainment of the percentage of those who die from diagnosed cases. Okay? So we need to understand diagnosis, and we need to understand how things are being diagnosed as well. We need to look at testing, we need to look at controversies around that, we need to look at uncertainties around that, and then determine that. Now, what has been determined, last time I checked, is the causal fatality rate in Australia is 1.38%. That's pretty close to zero, okay? Mm. So would a 1.38% causal fatality rate satisfy the terms of the legislation, okay? This is a question. I'm not answering these questions. I'm just saying this is the process under which we need to start to turn our attention. And what is really important here is that how do these powers operate? Okay? How do they operate? What can the health minister do and what he can't? And what has happened here is that instead of the health minister doing appropriate requirements and setting them on the federal level so that the states and territories followed, they just outsourced it all to the states and the territories. Okay? And the states and the territories are starting to act in a very ad hoc way against what the Biosecurity Act says, and in fact against some of what their own legislation says. And I will give an example. I will give a number of examples. What the Biosecurity Act says, you can set requirements that impact a group of people when it comes to the following aspects. And I will just get that. When it comes to, I'll get this. I've got so many notes here.
I can imagine.
What's here? So during a human biosecurity emergency period, this is section 477, the health minister may determine a requirement he or she is satisfied to prevent or control the entry of the disease. Okay? And what it is, these requirements are limited to this. The requirements that apply to persons, goods, conveyances when entering or leaving a specified place, in regards to the movement of persons or goods, and the restriction in terms of that movement and evacuation. That means you can only give directions on a group of people only in relation to very general things, like close of business, when to open, travel, export, import of goods, planes coming and going, ships leaving and coming, okay? You can do that on a group of people, issuing directives on a general thing. But the Biosecurity Act prevents from telling a group of people to do certain things, like masking, like isolating, like detaining, like vaccinating, like treatment, unless you issue an individual with the appropriate biosecurity control order. That means you can't just go to a group of people and tell them, all of you here, all of you, we don't care, we're not going to look at the details of each of your situations, you all got to be vaccinated. Or all of you here got to wear some masks. All of you here have to be detained, and all of you here have to be isolated. No, no, no. That is a big no-no under the Biosecurity Act. What you must do is follow very strict processes that are set to ensure the preservation of human rights and to ensure that the only basis under which you can issue a biosecurity control order are the following. And this is section 60 of the Biosecurity of the Biosecurity Act. So I will now talk to you about what a biosecurity control order, what it must consist of. Okay. Imposing a human biosecurity control order on an individual, that only can be done by a chief human biosecurity officer, a human biosecurity officer, or a biosecurity officer. Now, what do you have to do? A human biosecurity control order may be imposed on an individual only if the officer is satisfied of the following. The individual has one or more signs or symptoms of a listed human disease, or the individual has been exposed to a listed human disease, or another individual who has one or more signs of symptoms. That means you can't just go to anyone and say, hey, you have to be vaccinated, or you need to be isolated. You need to show that that individual is either themselves symptomatic of that disease, or you need to show the contact of who, the name, naming the person as to who they were contacted with who has the listed disease or the symptoms of the disease. And this is the criteria that is set under section 61 of the Biosecurity Act. Meaning, when you're issuing a Biosecurity Act, you need to tell the person the following. You need to tell them the ground under which you are actually ordering or imposing them to do something or not do something. You need to list the signs and the symptoms that they're suffering of the listed human disease. So unless you're actually symptomatic, they can't do anything to you, okay? Because this is all about prevention of risk. You have to show that you're an infectious risk or that you're a risk of infection, okay? And a perfectly healthy person who is not symptomatic, you can't just come and tell them to do something and tell them on a group level, okay? You have to go to them individually. Then what you need to say, you need to give them a unique identifier. You need to tell them exactly who they were contacted with, the name of the person that also has the signs and the symptoms. That means you can't just say, oh, we think that you're exposed. We're suspicious that you might be. No, that's not how the law works, okay? You have to actually trace that individual and name them. And very importantly, you have to give them the right of review. You have to give them the right of reviewing that decision to issue you a biosecurity control order to either ask you to be masked, to be vaccinated, to be treated, to be isolated, to be detained, to be diagnosed, to be medically tested, everything, even the testing. If you want or require someone to do testing, you have to give them all of these requirements through a biosecurity control order. Now, some states and territories have reflected that in their respective public health acts, but they're not following it. Mm. Victoria has section 117, and it says you have to issue the person a public health order. And they're not following their laws. They're not following their laws and telling the people individually if they're a particular risk. You don't just go to a perfectly healthy person and then say to them, oh, as a group, I'm not even concerned about your personal details. All of you, just do that, okay? And you can't do that particularly in an emergency powers. Why? Because otherwise it'll go crazy. And I'm going to give an example how things have gone out of control and in fact created more of a virus risk. So what happened in the detention towers? Let's look at what happened in the detention towers and apply the Biosecurity Act to it, okay, versus how they handled the crisis in a way that is completely breaching their own laws and breaching the laws of the federal legislature. They identified originally about 23 to about 50 cases. I've tried to get the exact numbers, but I believe it was 23. Who tested positive. Now, I'll come back to the problem with testing in just a little bit, okay? Yep. But assuming that these tests are reliable, for 1 minute, let's assume they are. But we'll come back to that later and we'll break that one apart as well, okay? But let's assume that these tests are positive, okay? You've got 23 people who tested positive out of 3,000, or that you've located, not just that you know that the rest are tested, but you know that you've tested and there's 23 here who are positive. If you genuinely believe that these people are symptomatic, now, by the way, a lot of them weren't symptomatic, okay, so they tested positive but weren't symptomatic. But let's assume they were, which they weren't. Well, let's assume, okay? Let's assume you've got 23 positive, you've got reliable tests, and 23 who are symptomatic. Do you then lock these people up with the other 3,000 people who potentially many of them can be healthy, and lock them up in one home confined in the small space and then bring to them 500 cops and then bring to them almost up to another 1,000 DHS staff in a very confined space where the whole notion is not to spread this virus. Bring in people who are not trained, okay, and bring in and detain them without them actually being issued anything under the law to tell them that where they have to be, what risk they are, what rights of review they have. You've done nothing of that. And they've said, well, they can do that. It's an emergency. You can do whatever you want, apparently. It's an emergency. But let's see what happened here. What happened here is that the police and the DHS, who are untrained, started to leave biosecurity hazard waste everywhere. It was coming out of the bins. It wasn't wrapped in double bins, okay? It was willy-nilly, the food that was delivered. People were delivering it without gloves, some without masks, some were wearing the PPE suit, some were not. They were putting the food in the rubbish bins. So yes, we have processes for the purpose of us not going mad. Because we have processes under the law that create the right balance between human rights and the need to create proper safety checks. Okay? So the law, if it was applied, the Biosecurity Control Act and the Biosecurity Act and the Public Health and Mental Wellbeing Act in Victoria, truly holistically being applied, we would not be applying it in an ad hoc, crazy fashion where we're exacerbating risks rather than containing risks.
Mm.
Okay? And that's why we have law. We have law because it gives us process. Process is extremely important when there's an emergency. That's the whole point of a process. You use the process when there's an emergency. You don't say, oh yeah, if there was no emergency, we would use the processes, but because there's an emergency, everything goes out the window. And unfortunately, that's not how the law works. You need to make a proper assessment of the individuals. If you felt that those individuals were at risk and were symptomatic, you could have isolated, you could have given them an individual order, told them to isolate somewhere else, provided their pay and accommodation, and provided them with the appropriate, respectful manner in which you treat them, okay? And I'm not saying don't do that, I'm saying do it properly. But don't go in and isolate and detain like a bunch of criminals, 3,000 individuals, who are the most vulnerable people in our society, and call it lawful. Okay? That's not lawful, and that is not risk mitigation. And what I have to say here is I'm appalled by the medical community. I'm appalled, because they're all like, oh, some of them are like, oh, all the doctors are against you. No, they're not. I've got 150 doctors and nurses that I'm representing. Okay? I'm connected to so many experts, internationally and locally, who are also saying this is wrong. But you've got the brainwashed, almost, no, I'm not going to listen to you, Serene. I'm not going to listen to what, well, who are you? Are you an expert or not? I'm not holding myself back to be an expert. I know my law. I'm a lawyer, and that's the only expertise I hold. But what I do know, and I'm also an accredited nutritionist as well, okay? But, you know, I'm not flaunting that or creating an expertise in that. But what I am saying is I've got my logic, I've got my law, I've got my research, I've got my brain, and as a lawyer, I'm able to research and present the arguments and get the experts that do know who actually can support these arguments. This is no consensus. There is no consensus on this. Okay, and people have to understand that there is no consensus on these issues. Okay? These issues are not like, oh, all of a sudden you disagree with government, therefore you're not scientific. Since when was government the authority of science? Since when does government own science and scientific opinion? And this is the danger that we're speaking of here. This is an extremely dangerous precedent. And we have the laws to support us. We have a scheme of human rights that has been introduced in this nation. If we look at this nation purely from what is written in the provisions and the common law, in our constitution, in our laws, you would think that we're living in the most amazing constitutionally right country in this world. But we shouldn't be afraid. You know, there's the fear and there's the hatred.
Yes.
And the hatred. I'll come back to testing in a minute, but I'll let you speak on the again. On the phone on the reality.
Well, given what's happened with the state of emergency in these towers, where is it right now with these people? Are they out and about? Are they, have they done their time?
Well, I'm representing the Melbourne Public Tenants Authority. It was put together as a response to the lack of representation, consolidated representation for the residents. There's almost 3,000 residents. You can imagine that community is very multicultural. Okay. The MPTA was set up by a wonderful man who is very concerned for his community. Okay, and he set it up with the view of consolidating the residents. He reached out to me, and I was so happy to get his call. You know, and he said, Serene, we need representation. Okay, we need to consolidate this because it appears that the government thinks it's a divide and conquer thing, and it's very easy to you know, because there's a lot of vulnerable people in that community, you know? A lot of vulnerable people who just don't want the cameras on them. You know, the whole world was looking at them. They just went, please leave us alone. You know, they don't want to, you know, they were so compliant. No kidding, they are just such lovely people. I mean, if this happened down at Frankston, I don't know what would happen there. I think people want to sit down and go, yeah, right, you know? But, you know, that's the thing, these people are lovely. These people are mannered. These people have kindness and suffered, and all they want is to be respected, and they were treated with disrespect. And so he reached out to me, and I'm representing them now, and we're urging as many residents to obviously have membership under the MPTA, okay? There's a lot of residents that now have joined, okay? And I'm happy with the representation, and he's working really hard to garner and collect as many of the residents as possible, okay? And I urge the residents, if they're listening to this, to also join MPTA, okay? Because with one voice, we can actually raise the concerns. And I have communicated to the Chief Health Officer, the Deputy Chief Health Officer, Daniel Andrews, and the Chief Police, and I set out to them how unlawful their actions are. Okay, now they've assigned it to the lawyers, and the lawyers are looking at it. So let's see what happens. Okay?
Yes,
and I hope
watch this space.
Yeah, I hope they look at it very carefully. Because I'm not going away, okay? And this is the message that I'm not going away, okay? This is not going away, okay? We have powerful arguments here. And these people have been treated abominably ill. You know, abominably ill. Some of the worst treatment that I have seen, okay? And ridiculous to bring in police under the law. You can't. You can't. Under the Biosecurity Act, you can't use force. Mm-hmm. Police is absolutely the last resort for enforcement. You have to be issued the biosecurity control order, then you have to be issued an enforcement order. And only if you breach it, then you can bring the police. You don't bring in 500 cops overnight and expect people to be okay with that. That's
so
not...
do you have any inkling as to why it was done like this, Serene?
Oh, I don't know, but it sounds to me like, I don't know, who does it? Power trip? Bullies? I mean, you know, I work with a lot of bullies every day. I fight bullies every day. You know, and this is another thing. People are so conditioned to think that, you know, bureaucracies are there to love them and help them.
Well, I wasn't there on that lady's presentation. That's not all of it. But, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow. Same time. And I sign off tonight as I always do with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot, and plenteous store abound. And ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless, the maple leaf forever.